Dr. Rock's radio show. Every Thursday night at 9 on raconteursnews.com. We go to 11.
Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on raconteursnews.com. Oh, that seems a little bit quiet, but it doesn't look like it's going to go any louder, so that'll have to be it, folks. That was the Black Star Riders and Sex, Guns and Gasoline, and before that the Alabama 3. Woke up this morning, got myself a gun. It's been one of those weeks at the surgery when you can kind of understand where they're coming from on that one, but we're trusting that the pen and paper's probably going to work better than the gun. And we kicked off with the Asian Dub Foundation and Real Great Britain from their Community Music album. Big thanks to Tony for those tunes before the show. I really enjoyed those. We were rocking away here. That was great. I think you'd be hard pushed to find another radio station that's turning out that kind of quality. Or perhaps it's just that there's not many out there catering to my tastes or whatever. But cheers for that, Tony. It was brilliant. Anyway, we've got a posse at home show tonight, which is really great. No external guests. I'm actually sharing a microphone with Synchro for the first time for a while. Hi, Synchro.
Hello there.
It's really good. She's joining us because we've got a slideshow, because as most of you will know, she went recently for a few weeks high walking in Bolivia and Peru. And we've stuck up a slideshow on the website for you, so most of you can see it in the chat box at raconteursnews.com. If you're not in the chat box, and I know there's plenty of you out there, why not come on in and join us? It's lovely in here. But for those of you that might be listening on the pod, I shall just read out the link. If you put in internetradio.dr-rock.biz, so that should look like internetradio.dr-rock.biz, /download/walking in Bolivia and Peru, and there's dots in between each of those words, .pdf, and that's the only time you're going to get that, because you should be in the chat box anyway, because it makes life so much easier for us. So anyway, Synchro, we're kicking off the slideshow with this marvelous picture of that looks like a pretty nifty kite. What's that then?
Well, that's a condor, isn't it? I'd heard about them and I'd seen films of them, but I'd never actually seen one fly before. And it is a pretty uplifting thing. They do look just like that. And the sky was blue. And apparently, I mean, they are just looking for meat. They range around up there on the thermals looking for meat, looking for dead meat. They don't usually go for live animals. They go for animals that are already pretty much dead. And beautiful, majestic creatures to watch. Really, really uplifting. Makes you wish you want to fly, really.
I mean, it looks huge from here. Our kites have got, what, a 6-foot wingspan, couple of metres? I mean, how big's that?
These are bigger than our kites, but I'm not sure quite how much. I think they go up to about a 2.5-metre wingspan or something like that. They're bigger than our kites.
Did you see any on the ground or only in the air?
No, only in the air. We saw some other birds on the ground, the caracara, which are big black and white birds, and they apparently work with the condors. They call them in to attack a very weak and dying baby llama, and then the condor will break into it, and then the caracara. So they work a bit like the ravens and the wolves together.
Oh, that's clever, isn't it? So this guy is basically carrion, but he's got mates who are kind of better at the hunting thing. And then they get the benefit as well, because it's bigger and stronger and can actually tear into the corpse more effectively.
That's exactly the way they're working as a team, aren't they?
We should try that sometime, aren't we? So frequent listeners will probably remember the nightmare you had when you tried to fly from here to Mexico via Denver or wherever it was. Did your flight go any better this time?
Yeah, it was pretty cool, actually. I mean, I don't like all that business in airports, you know, but I keep my head down and just go through it, basically. And no, it was great. I mean, not going through America is the best thing we did. We flew to Lima from Madrid, and then from Lima to Cusco, and that was brilliant. An hour's flight over the mountains, seeing the snowy mountains. But the long haul bit, the 12 hours from Madrid to Lima, is, it's just interminable, you know, unless you can sleep.
Yeah. Was it worth it?
Yes.
I'm glad, because we wouldn't be looking at the pictures otherwise, would we? So that's good, that. And just as a matter of interest, when in your initial contacts with people, with, you know, travel agents, whatever they call them, did they try to encourage you to go through America again initially?
No. I was very lucky because I had my friend Justine. She was looking for the tickets and she was doing it all online. And I said to her, if you can find a way for us to go to Lima without going through America, then that will make things a lot easier. Mm. So she did all that, which was brilliant. And I just had to then pay for the ticket. So that was great. I didn't have to do any of that business.
So if we have a look at the slide two, which is called Titicaca and Bolivia, we're cheating a bit, aren't we? Because you spent a bit of time in Peru before you headed for Bolivia, but we're going to look at the Bolivia photographs first. And what's this we're looking at? What a fabulous looking place, isn't it? Look at that, and the mountains and sea and sky, for those of you who can't see it.
Well, this is Lake Titicaca, and I've always wanted to go there, and finally got there, and I was well chuffed in many ways. I mean, it is a big lake, and it behaves a bit like a sea. It has waves, and it can get pretty wild and stuff. But and we did see it getting pretty wild a couple of times. But this view was amazing from Lake Titicaca, and those were the mountains that we ended up going into. Part of that range is the Apolobamba Range, which is in the northeast of Lake Titicaca. Because Peru and Bolivia both have a part of Lake Titicaca. The border runs through the middle of the lake. So you can come down through Peru and then cross the border into Bolivia, and you're on the lake the whole time. But these mountains were in Bolivia, and they're on the northeast side of the lake, which is a pretty wild and remote part of Bolivia. I mean, a lot of Bolivia is pretty remote and wild, but...
So Lake Titicaca itself is, about 10 or 12,000 feet? So, and you're going in there. What sort of height were you getting to when you...
Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny because you're by a sea. It's so big. It's like you feel like you're by the sea, but of course it's a lake and it's at 12,000 feet. And we'd come from Cusco, which is 11,000 feet, and that was pretty high. And then we went up into the mountains and we went up to 15, 16,000 feet. But at least we were acclimatizing on Lake Titicaca. That was all part of the acclimatization. If you don't do that, you can get really sick.
And you were with a party of people. How did all of you deal with the altitude? Were you all right?
Some people found it harder than others, I think. It took a little bit of time for some people to acclimatize because they'd come straight into La Paz. If you fly into La Paz in Bolivia, you're arriving at a really high altitude, like about 15,000 feet or something like that. You're arriving, and if you're coming straight from Britain or somewhere low down, then you're really going to feel the altitude. And if you've only had a few days to acclimatise before you go up into even to 12,000 feet, you're going to find it really hard. Some people found it better than others. Of course, we had the coca.
Yeah, which we will get to, of course. And there are some pictures of the very high passes coming up, and my goodness, they look formidable. They really do. And the next shot is, the winter solstice. I love this shot because really, in its way, this really reminds me of the summer solstice in here, because that's kind of what it used to look like. Loads of multicoloured people and people wrapped in blankets and... You know, I'm not sure we ever saw a blue sky like that. So what was it like? Where were you when all this was going on? Who are all these people?
Well, this was brilliant. We were staying on the Island of the Sun in the middle of Lake Titicaca, which is as romantic as it sounds. It really is amazing there. There's no cars there. And they have this big gathering there every solstice. And we were there for the winter solstice, which is June the 21st. And we got up before dawn, when it was still dark, walked up this mountain, and got there. It was freezing cold up there before people started lighting fires, and then there were these massive fires. Everybody was passing round the spirits and the coca and cigarettes and all sorts of stuff being passed around. And then when the sun came up, there was this big ceremony, loads of mad dancing, and it was a treat to be up there. And the music was brilliant. It was.
And what about security? I mean, how safe were people?
Well, what's that? Everybody was having a great time, and there was no security apart from the stuff we took with us.
So was it cold? It was cold at night. Was it cold during the day? What was it like?
No, it was really cold at night. And I mean, the stars and the sky were just incredible down there. It's the first time I'd ever seen a southern sky. So it's all different. It's all like really different, very strange. But the daytime was really warm and sunny, and the nighttime was really cold. And then in the morning, there were frosts everywhere. So it was middle of winter. You know, they were lighting fires all over the place to try and warm the land up and keep the animals warm, which was a strange kind of practice, I thought, because I didn't think it would make much difference. But there were fires everywhere, and that's traditional at this time of year, apparently.
That's probably useful, having all of those alpacas and llamas and all these really fabulous kind of fabrics and things they make, because we'll see some of those as well. The next picture, number four, I called it giant donkey, because compared with the lady, it does look like a giant donkey, but it's perhaps she's quite small and it is quite a big donkey. What's the actual situation there?
It's not a particularly big donkey. I think she's quite short and quite rotund, as you can see. So many of the Bolivian women were very large, big women. And they also wear like 22 skirts, as many skirts as they can possibly wear. But they're.
And are they all beautiful skirts? Is it layer upon layer, or are the ones underneath quite plain?
It's the outer one that is the most important one, and they go for really glitzy stuff. They quite like fancy new velvets, but a lot of the traditional fabrics are amazing. Now, we were using donkeys on the Island of the Sun to bring our gear down to the landing stage to get off, to get back, and we visited the Island of the Moon first, which is also amazing. Being out on Lake Titicaca is quite a fantastic experience, and visiting these islands.
Did you see any UFOs flying in and out of it then?
No, we didn't. But we met a guy who gave us as fact that he had seen a craft flying in and out of Lake Titicaca, because it's got its triangle in the centre, formed by the Island of the Sun, the Island of the Moon, and this other little island, which we also visited. There's this triangle there, which apparently a lot of people have seen craft flying in and out of, and he stated it as fact.
I just scored a book, which is a 1970s classic on that particular subject, and it's called Invisible Residents, and it's about UFOs and undersea objects, and it's a pretty fascinating book, but more of that later. I really like the pack animal thing, because I'd quite like to have an animal, but you know, to live with an animal, but I'm not interested in having one as a pet. But if you've got one that's going to wander off to the market with you and cart all the stuff back, and maybe, you know, if you've been down the alehouse or whatever, cart you back as well. I mean, were there lots of animals that were used for that?
Yeah, well, everybody was using animals on the island, especially on the Island of the Sun. But when we went trekking in the mountains as well, we had pack animals to carry our gear.
Yeah, I can't see any paperwork on him. How's he taxed, insured and MOT'd? How do they manage that then? Talking of which, the next one, slide number five, is it's got a really, isn't it? It's the police station, the Policia Boliviana, with a really friendly looking kind of Top Cat style PC Dibble sort of policeman on it. They let you out then. What were you doing in there?
Well, I'll cut a long story short here, but we ended up in this town called Escoma, you can see it on the sign there, with nowhere to stay, literally. We'd been in another town and all the hotels were full. This was an unexpected journey as well. We weren't expecting to make this particular journey. So we were out of time. We had nowhere to stay. And our guide went up to the police station and he was throwing stones at the top floor window to try and wake the policeman up. And initially he said no to us and told us to go and find somewhere else. And this was about half past midnight in this town and everybody was asleep. We went and tried the town square and tried to knock some people to see if we could find somewhere, nowhere to be seen. So we went back to the police station and our guide tried again. And this time he let us in and there were about 12, 13 of us, and we slept on this concrete floor in this kind of semi half built police station. All of us slept there for the night. We had about 5 or 6 hours sleep, but we'd have been stuck in a minibus. We'd have been stuck in a minibus all night, all of us, and that would have been very fractious.
It would have been nice and warm.
Would have been an absolute nightmare because we'd already spent about 15 hours in this minibus.
So we're kind of used to the 24-hour lifestyle here, aren't we, with Tesco opening for singles hours and all that kind of stuff. So it's good to know that there's still towns in the world where everything stops when it gets dark.
Yeah, absolutely everything. There was nobody around at all, just the occasional dog in the square. And I think there was somebody drunk asleep on a bench. And a few people were actually trying to fix their Land Rover. So they were poor sods had broken down there, but there was nobody around. It was deadly.
So there weren't a lot of people sleeping out either, because I know in Mexico there was a fair bit of that, wasn't there? People sleeping in the park. They were living in the parks and things in Mexico, weren't they?
Well, that was in the city, so yeah. Maybe in the city there's more of that. I don't know. This was just a small town, and there was one guy asleep on a bench, you know.
Next one, there's number 6, Llamas and Landscape. I really like that one. There's you're kind of getting up into the mountains there, I guess. And did you see lots of the other ones, the furry ones, the alpacas?
Yeah, we saw lots and lots of llamas, as they're called there, because it's a double L. It's the Y sound. So llamas and alpacas. And we also saw the wild creature that's still wild, the vicuna. Not the mother and father of these guys. These were separate. Apparently they originally came from North America, the llamas and the alpacas, but now they're pretty much naturalized there, and vast flocks of them, and they can survive at very high altitudes, as you can see. This was pretty high. We were going over about 13,000 feet here.
Yeah.
14,000 feet maybe. So that was really high, kind of altiplano, as they call it, high plain, before we went down to Pelechuca, the town where we started our trek from.
Yeah, I can't help thinking it'd be really interesting to try and get some sort of trip to go and see how they treat the animals, what happens to them and things like that, if they've got vast herds of them, and they only use them for the wool, because they do eat the llamas as well, don't they, as well as guinea pigs?
Yeah, they eat the llamas, and they use them as pack animals too. But most of these big herds are for the wool and for the meat, I guess, as well. So they will eat when a llama dies, or when perhaps they kill them specially for the meat. Probably do, in fact.
Yeah. And the next one is the mountain water. I really like that. Presumably, unlike... Well, you can still drink it in Wales as long as you check it out for dead sheep first, can't you, in theory? And, of course, the all the bloody chicken farms that are poisoning them anyway. But the water there was clear, was it? Drinkable?
It was. I mean, you had to make fairly sure you were fairly near the source, you know. You didn't want to have any human habitation or, like, herds maybe of animals and stuff. But, yeah, you could drink the water straight from the springs, straight from the streams, which, like you say, you can do here as long as you make sure you're near the source. The source of the Y up the road here is as pure as you're going to get, really.
That literally springs out of a hole in the rock, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's great. It's a bit like the picture there, really. The source of the River Y is comes gushing out of the rocks in a biblical fashion, you know. It's great.
And the next one, slide number 8, is one of my personal favourites. This is just wicked, this one. It's a kind of switchback. If you look at it really carefully, you can see that it's called Mountain Pass. And the path kind of comes by you in the foreground and then runs away and snakes its way into the dead centre of the picture. And if you look just to the right of that, that's the path down. So you go swinging round this thing. And look at it. It's like it's higher than absolutely everything up there. And I really find myself wondering if I could even maintain my concentration and not just sort of wander off. How long were you traversing something like that then?
Well, I mean, that's a pass we'd just come over. So we'd spent a lot of time walking up. And then you spend a lot of time walking down the other side. There weren't many ridges to walk along for any length of time.
We just seen Andy's little emoticon there. So I quite agree, Andy. Yeah.
But you know, you're up there, so you've got to do it. You know, you put one foot in front of the other, and you carry on. You know.
Do they take pack animals over these?
Oh yeah, the pack animals went everywhere we went.
Oh, you had your own pack. How many?
We did. Yeah, we had a bunch of donkeys, about 12 donkeys, carrying all the gear for this trip. Yeah, it was quite a well organised trip. You know, it was all right, and we didn't have much to do with the donkey herders. They kind of had their own scene. Yeah. They, I think, we had cooks as well cooking for us, with mixed success. You know, but. You know, it was all right. It was okay. And the I think we fed, our cooks fed the donkey herders as well.
How many of you were kind of all together, you know, with the donkey herders and the cooks and you and your guides and all of that?
There must have been about, there was 12 of us with our guide, 9 of us with the guides, cooks, 3. There must have been another 5 or 6 donkey people.
Yeah. That's quite a substantial number. That's actually quite a good moving community, isn't it? How did they all get on with each other this time?
Pretty good. I mean, I think it was really good that we had some Bolivian guides with us, because they were really good at their jobs, and they got on with everybody, regardless of any, because they were professionals, regardless of any internal feuds that might have been happening, or, you know. So although the group, our 9, if you like, didn't gel particularly well, I have to be honest. There were times when it was working and stuff, but having the native Bolivian people with us helped enormously in that process, I think.
Got to be a sign of a quality guide, I would have thought. I'd also say that in a landscape like that, I think I'd probably want a quality guide, actually.
Absolutely. I mean, they were brilliant. The Percy, our main guide, walking guide, took the lead with us the whole time. And he was local. He was from the village of Pelachuca, which is where we started. And it was basically a walk in his back garden, and he'd done it many times. So he really knew the landscape very well. And he was very patient with us, because we obviously weren't as fast as him. Some of us were kind of faster walkers than others. But yeah, he was brilliant, Percy.
Mm. And the next shot along number 9 is just called Mountain. I didn't have time this morning. We were thinking of going and looking at the atlas and trying to find out what they're all called. But, you know, have you got any names that people could go and look at a map to give them some idea of where this thing that's just labelled Mountain is? Beautiful shot, though.
Not really. I mean, the best thing people can do if they want to have a look at this trek is to go and do a search on walking from Pelachuca to Charazani. So it's in the Apolobamba range to the northeast of Lake Titicaca. So you can find out about the route and I read tonight it's apparently described as an advanced trek. So I'm kind of well chuffed that I managed to do a trek that was described as advanced.
I'll say it's a bloody advanced trek, doing that sort of thing at 16,000 feet. And I mean, here's another one, the next one, Mountain Pass, slide number 10. That looks just like some of those cracking shots you got for your pilgrimage walk. You know, there's somebody, is that you? I don't know, somebody coming this way, somebody walking the other way, and absolutely nothing else in sight at all. Another great shot, I think. I like that one.
Well, there's a big relief, I think, when you get to the top of a pass. If you might have been walking up, struggling a bit, maybe for like 4 hours, and then you finally get there. And that is part of the thing about walking up mountains, I think, is that fantastic feeling of, oh, you know, exhilaration and like you've done it, achievement, you know, you've done it. And I was dead chuffed, like I say, that I was physically capable of doing this. Yeah.
I think I'd be needing more than a doctor if I was to try something like that. And something that must be really good about walking up something that's big is turning round every now and then and seeing how everything behind you's changed.
Yeah, you've got to keep an eye on what's behind you as well as what's in front of you. And of course, I was, and a few of us were chewing the coca leaves all the time. And they really, really help with altitude. Mm. They really help with the altitude. They also, you know, yes, you do feel a bit high. I mean, you're high anyway, so you might as well just chew coca and get on with it.
But the coca leaves were everywhere, weren't they?
Yeah, everybody was doing it, you know. I had some coca leaf toffees with me. I had half a kilo of coca leaves with me. Everybody had, like, big bags of coca leaves with them. And we used them for offerings and when we were meditating and stuff. We used the coca leaves with intent or good intent. But quite often, with me anyway, it was my preferred thing to chew as I was walking. You make a wad of, you make like a flat plate of coca leaves in your hand, and then you put about half a teaspoon of bicarbonate of soda in the middle of it, wrap it up into a ball, got good at this, and then you put it into your cheek and you just let it seep, a very, very gentle, feel good, an invigorating, high thing for hours on end, and it really helps with the altitude.
Yeah, and what does the bicarb do?
Well, it multiplies the effect of the coca many, many times. So it's even better at oxygenating the blood when you've got bicarb in there. And it does make you feel a little higher, shall we say. And I mean, like I say, you're already at 15,000 feet. So.
Well, I know you brought those little coca sweets back with you, which I found to be actually pretty bloody potent. Your mouth went numb. You did actually get a very mellow, kind of relaxing hit out of it as well. Was chewing the coca like that?
Very much like that. It's just that they it lasted longer. It would last for hours. The good wodge that you put in your cheek, you're not really meant to chew it, although I ended up chewing them up. You're not really meant to chew it. You're meant to just suck them from for hours and benefit from it. And then I suppose you're meant to spit them out, but I used to eat them because I thought, well, that's meant to be a good one.
Waste not, one not, eh? Well, we'll be seeing where the coca came from in a bit. The next shot, number 11, is called Another Mountain Pass. And that is, I think, a really awesome photo. Somebody else took that one, didn't they? And that's you there, isn't it? That's synchro in that shot next to that giant rock. Very awesome, I think. Let's go to the next one. Oh, look, we've got the Bolivian sheep. More llamas there for people. And for some reason, that slide snuck in again. So you got two shots of the Bolivian. That's what they are, though, isn't it? They are Bolivian sheep, basically.
They're everywhere, yeah. Up on in the highland, there's just herds of them everywhere. And they're cute, and they're not a problem. They mind their own business, and, yeah, they're lovely. Oh, that's one of my faves. That is an ancient settlement we saw, a traditional settlement, which was still being lived in. And I managed in my, you know, improving Spanish to have a chat with the guy that was living there, and we both agreed how tranquillo, you know, how tranquil the place was. And he knew what was happening, you know, he could see the changes that were happening to his country, but he was choosing to carry on to live in the traditional way.
And did you see many kind of little settlements around? Because I'm looking at this, we're seeing dry stone wall, nice curved dry stone wall in the foreground. And next to a couple of, probably two or three buildings, they've got kind of grass roofs, which would have been kind of thatched around here. They look like stone with some sort of soft mortar in them, those buildings. Did they do soft mortar?
They're probably adobe bricks.
Yeah,
they're probably bricks. Stone and brick stone mixed, and brick maybe, because they do a lot of that as well.
It's not far off what you would have seen around here kind of 150 years ago, that's not.
It's very true. No, I mean, the traditional building techniques were becoming a thing of the past, although, as we'll see in a bit, they still use the adobe bricks a lot. This photograph is pretty sad, really, because this, compared to the last one we just saw, is the state of the building that's going on now. The epitome of modernity is to be using newly made extruded bricks with corrugated aluminium roofs. That is the modern way, and that is the way it's going there on a massive scale. I've never seen anything like the scale of building work that's going on in Bolivia with no apparent plan at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what strikes me about this slide that I called development, is you've got a bunch of buildings that, I mean, that last lot we saw, they're so nestled into the landscape and they look well together, you know, and quite often we see in these old settlements kind of buildings that are clustered usefully. This just looks like a kind of a random selection of very unprepossessing modern buildings. There's what looks to be a burnt out or otherwise wrecked car in the foreground, and it's no trees. It's just amazing, isn't it? And you said that Bolivia was really largely like that. That it sounds like a very strange place.
Well, you know, they're building all these massive, great, big new roads there, and all this development that's happening there is new build, indiscriminate building. It seems to me, you know, there isn't a plan for proper sanitation works, and there's massive pollution going on in the rivers, and the roads are being placed in all over the place. It's like they're laying this modern infrastructure on a country which hasn't really moved from traditional subsistence agriculture, and they're having this infrastructure just laid on them from outside development money. Who knows where the money for all this building is coming from? But it's very little to do with the traditional people. I think they still form 80% of the population of Bolivia.
Yeah.
You know.
So do they have many big cities there?
Not that many. I mean, La Paz is one of them, which is the only one I went to. It's not even the capital city of Bolivia, I don't think. That's somewhere else. So, yeah, they've got cities, but they're very few and far between. And most of the people still live in the countryside one way or another in a fairly low-key subsistence way.
I should imagine, in my cynical way, that the infrastructure is going in the better to enslave the population further down the line. And you said you saw kind of graffiti there and stuff, which was just saying yes and no, and that was about as far as the debate seemed to be going.
Well, yes, Evo Morales is their current prime minister, and he comes from he is a native Bolivian man from the Kalawaya tribe, which is actually near, this guy is a Kalawaya,
the curandero
slide. In this slide that we're, the next slide we're going to see is from that area. So it seems to me that about half of Bolivia approves of Evo Morales and about half of Bolivia don't. So massive signs up everywhere. There are a lot of people in Bolivia really want to express their political views, and they just do graffiti everywhere to express that. Because nobody's reading newspapers out in the sticks. They don't exist.
You said you saw some quite big public meetings in Peru. Did you see any in Bolivia?
Yes, we did, actually, on one of the islands, on the island of the moon, where there were no cars and nothing catering for tourists, which I must admit I found really refreshing. Mm. There wasn't a tourist shop there at all. So we visited this island, and you're perfectly free to wander over the island, and we did, went to this temple of the moon. You could go wherever you wanted to on the island, but there was nothing there to cater for you. And the people were having a massive meeting on the football pitch down by the dock, by the where the boats come in. And it was fantastic to see, and they paid us absolutely no attention whatsoever. So it was great to see that big public meeting thing still happening, and I think everybody from the island was there. And I thought, that's great. Everybody's at the meeting. And if it's about their lives, then surely everybody should be there, you know?
Well, it should be, isn't it? And what, did football pitches big over there, are they?
Oh, yeah, especially in Bolivia. I mean, every single village had a football pitch, and quite often they had corrugated aluminium covered baseball court. And sometimes small villages had two built football pitches with concrete stadiums round them. And I mean, these guys hardly had electricity, you know, and they had these enormous football pitches. And it is very popular in Bolivia. And people, there are some famous Bolivian footballers, I think.
Yeah, there probably are. Yeah, I guess that's another nice little earner, though, isn't it? Building huge stadia everywhere.
We didn't see a single one of them being used.
Oh, really? You do surprise me. So what about this Kieran Darrow? Did you have any dealings with him? What sort of stuff was he doing out there? Lovely llama, isn't it?
Yeah, very beautiful. He brought this llama. He was using it as a pack animal there to bring grain to the town. And we went to visit this guy at his home. And that's his wife on the right with the loom there. And she's weaving his poncho for his next year of office as an influential man in the community. And he knew he was going to be this important person next year. And she knew as well that she was going to be acting at his side for the whole year. Because whenever they have a man in office, there must be a balancing female, a woman, to work with him to advise and discuss whatever it is they're going to be doing throughout the year, which I think is brilliant.
Yeah, I agree. And so are the clothes. Do the clothes perhaps tell you something about these people's offices then, what they do?
Yeah, of course they do. They're very particular. Her weaving included his talents and skills and birds to work with him over the year. And, yeah, it was full of meaning. This was not just a pretty piece of cloth that she was doing here.
I noticed that's a flat loom. We'll see pictures of ones that they use around trees later. They seem to have several different ways of weaving. How many did you see?
Well, this is basically the same method. It's just that the loom has been pegged into the ground using those pegs you can see sticking up either side of her there. Yes. So instead of tying it round a tree to keep it taut, they're using pegs to keep the warp taut.
And she's got, I mean, look at the cloak she's wearing, and what a great hat. These guys can really do hats.
Yeah, they were amazing. They were actually selling a bit of their stuff as well, and some of our group bought some of their stuff. I think she makes quite a good living out of selling a few things to passing, you know, interested people or whatever.
But she is selling good quality, beautiful things, which is more than can be said for certain tatmongers around here.
You know, you get to meet the woman who's made it and meet the curandero, the healer guy who wore it last year, you know.
And the next one, which says mountain on it, most informally, you know I like to do things a bit tighter than that, but not this time around. That's the mountain that you spent some time wandering around. I guess that's the kind of holy mountain of this trip. Is it sacred mountain?
Yeah, that's Akamani, which also has its female counterpart. And we wandered around Akamani for a few days. We actually went over the pass as well, which was very close to the summit of Akamani. I can hardly believe me saying that now, but yeah, we did do that.
Wow, and I really love the way this ridge in front of it echoes exactly the shape of the bigger thing behind it. It's very fractal, isn't it?
Yeah, it was an amazing landscape to walk through. You know, it was pretty barren up there. We were above the tree line for the whole walk, so there was no wood for fires or anything like that. But it was a pretty stunning landscape to be walking in.
So, I mean, taken from this viewpoint, how far or how many days were you away from that mountain? Because it looks like it kind of goes all the way down and all the way up and all the way down and up. What was happening there?
No, I think we went round that thing in front. So it was probably about a day's walk to the pass from there.
Yeah. Spectacular. Spectacular. And, down to the doctors. This is a very pretty looking place. I love the colours. What did you do in there?
This was amazing. We had an appointment. This is a herbal hospital. And they did use some allopathic medicine as well, but most of it was done herbally here. And we all had an appointment with this amazingly intuitive doctor, and it was up to us what we took to him. So everybody took their own problems, whether they be, you know, mental, emotional or physical. You could take whatever you wanted to him. And he certainly helped me. He had some insights into my condition, if you like. And he helped some people with things that they'd been wondering about for years. How they fared, I don't know, because he gave us herbal teas and pastes and all sorts of things to use. I haven't actually used mine yet because the problem I took to him healed itself of its own accord since I was there. So
might as well have the tea anyway, eh?
I will try the tea. I certainly will. But it's almost as if he had something to do with the healing without me ever drinking the tea.
We do know, however, that there are still people out in the hills in Wales creating salves and teas and things to help fix damaged enduro riders, aren't there?
Yeah, yeah, still there. Bone setters and the like. And I think we should be making sure that we keep our communication lines with those people open.
I wonder how well this guy would do if he tried to open up a clinic down in London or something and, you know, fix people using herbs and stuff.
Well, there's people there trying to do that, aren't there, I guess. There's herbalists practising, so we have that option.
Yeah. Well, here's the next one. Number 19 is the last one of the Bolivian shots. And we'll have a bit of local music that Jess brought back with her, 5 or 6 minutes of music. But that one's just called Costume. And look at the way that lady's dressed. What style is that, eh?
It's really quite difficult to get photographs of the amazing costumes that the Bolivian women wear. And, of course, they're the hat wearers as well. So they wear these amazing, really tall bowler hats. But in this area, they're wearing things that look like elaborate tea cosies. But, I mean, look at the breadth of that woman. They all have this breadth. And she's wearing about 22 skirts and a fantastic shawl with tassels. And it was only because she had her back to me that I could take such a wonderful photograph of her, you know.
That's the one. They don't like having their photos taken, so you have to shoot them in the back, as it were, I guess.
Well, that's it. I had to find ways of getting photographs of the people in the markets and in these amazing costumes, yeah, without appearing to take a photograph. And that's where the zoom lens is actually quite useful.
The zoom lens, and Tony's put wide load in there. Yeah. Yes, they do seem to be quite close to the ground and quite wide. That's why that's why the donkey earlier on looked so big.
Yeah, they do. I mean, it's, I don't know why, but the women all seem to be this kind of quite large size. And I mean, I looked at some of the skirts in the shops, but you know, you could have fitted about four of me in one of these skirts.
So what are they eating? What's their staple?
They do eat a lot of kind of stodgy food and meat and stuff. If you go to the markets, then the locals are eating masses of potatoes, rice, meat, fat.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, big carbs, which is strange, isn't it? Because as we're going to see, oh, mind you, that's Bolivia. In Peru, there's got plenty of other things to eat apart from that. In fact, I mean, I would guess that the diet in Bolivia, looking at the infrastructure and all that, was the whole thing was probably genuinely a bit more primitive than Peru, was it?
Yeah, and there are big differences between the way the two countries kind of operate. And I think Bolivia has a long way to go to sort of catch up with Peru. Maybe people in the country have lovely vegetables and stuff in Bolivia, but I didn't see an awful lot of evidence of that where I was. Certainly in Peru, there was a lot more stuff available, and the roads were a lot more sorted, and the, you know, sanitation was a lot more sorted. And in a way, Bolivia was, yeah, quite kind of backward in that sense, in those kind of ways.
Yeah, interesting that two countries so close to each other can be so different. Well, we'll take a bit of a musical break now, and a comfort break. This is a CD that Jess brought back with her. It's by a bunch called Tsui Peru, who you actually saw performing, didn't you?
I did, in a bar in a restaurant one night, yeah, and they just got me with a CD.
But this is apparently a tune that you hear everywhere around now. It's called Condor Pasa, so everybody knows it. But this being done by pretty effective musicians on genuine kind of local instrumentation. There's about 6 minutes or so of it, and then we'll come back and look at some pictures of Peru. Top for being there, folks. Dr. Rock's radio show on raconteursnews.com, and tonight I'm having an at-home night with Synchro, and we're talking about Peru and Bolivia.
Thank you. Thank you.
bit of local cafe colour there from Tsui Peru. I'm not sure how you say that, but that's, as we say, a CD that Jess picked up. It's got a couple of really nice little tunes on it, which we'll probably introduce when the time is right. In the meantime, we're back with our little slideshow. I'll just put the thingy for it, the link for it, back in the chat box there. Hang on a moment. I'm holding a mic and managing all the buttons. Yeah, looking good. I'm trusting you can hear me out there. And the first shot after the break, it says complimentary medicine, and it's a shaman shop where I presume you just don't buy shamans. Like the comment, Nick, about it's got three girt padlocks on the door, so it can't be much of a shaman. Did you go in there? What could you buy in there, Synchro?
Well, all manner of stuff. You know, they were advertising ayahuasca retreats and San Pedro ceremonies, and selling crystals and pipes and black tobacco and pan pipes and just all manner of stuff, really. I mean, baby llamas.
So the ayahuasca and stuff, did they have any of the San Pedro, of course, is pretty general over there, isn't it? Those are their basic power plants, teacher plants, are they there? Apart from the coca, of course.
Yeah, well, yeah, San Pedro was very popular, and in this amazing market in Cusco, you could go and buy San Pedro cactus by the meter and take it home. I saw people wandering around with these enormous cacti over their shoulders, which... taking them home. I mean, I shouldn't think they'd let you export them for a minute, but apparently the process, I don't know much about it, but the process for making the San Pedro into what it is you want to take to have the San Pedro experience is quite a complex process, a bit like the ayahuasca, I think. I think you really need to do that with somebody who really knows what they're doing, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. I love the idea of somebody just dragging a huge one over his shoulder and taking it home, though. And once again, were we to try that sort of thing round here, of course, we'd probably get ourselves into all sorts of trouble. They really don't like us dragging plants around and making use of them, do they? Next shot is entitled Trick Brick Masonry and Mark. And what a fabulous doorway, eh? Look at that. They could really do things in the old days, couldn't they?
Yeah, I mean, Cusco's an amazing city, and all over the place is this incredible stonework, and there'll be another photo, I think, of some of that. And this is just a doorway, which is a very old doorway, and incredible. And then I noticed this detail that you can see on the right there of this incredibly complex stone that they've put in there. Almost for fun, it seems to me. The rest of the stonework looks pretty sane, and then they've done this, you know.
Yeah, it looks like they've been playing a game of Tetris and they thought, hey, let's make a bloody door out of it. That's got 14 edges on it, that stone.
That's incredible. And that step pattern that you can see there, those three steps, are really, really common in the stonework there. And it represents the three worlds, the lower world, the middle world and the higher world. And we've got those three worlds represented in the Celtic mythology as well.
Which one of those do they think we're in?
I think we're in the middle world.
Yeah, I suspect that's hopefully going to turn out. I'm hoping. Seems to, well, whatever. Anyway, and then there's that really amazing carving, which is over the door, and I suspect probably isn't the age of that 14-edged brick in there. But again, it's a pretty amazing little thing. It's got it looks like a coat of arms with a hat on top of it, and there's a dragon in some kind of castle and a sort of little house with a bloke and a flag standing on top of it and all manner of stuff in there. And I guess I can't help wondering who put that over that door. I just thought, pretty amazing piece of stonework really there. Just spotted it on the way through. Next slide, slide 22, is Sacsayhuaman. And I just can't look at this particular site enough, really. It's great to have a shot that's been taken by somebody, at least somebody I know who's been there. What a fabby place. What was that like to actually see that?
Oh, it's brilliant. I mean, you have to walk up above the city. You go straight up out of Cusco and it brings you to Sacsayhuaman, which is quite interesting if you haven't got acclimatised to the altitude yet, because even though it's not a very steep walk, it can be quite difficult for people to get there. But the local people, of course, are running up and down these steps to get up to Sacsayhuaman. It was much easier the second time I was there, after I'd been up in the mountains in Bolivia, than it was the first time I went up there. But, yeah, the scale of the place is fantastic. And the way those rocks are fitted together, the vastness of the landscape and the view over Cusco. And, of course, there was... People can read about the history of Sacsayhuaman and how it was destroyed, how it was used as a place of defence. And it's been through, there's been a lot of history up there. It was massively destroyed from what it was originally like.
Who knows what the hell it was before it was massively destroyed, that's all I can say. Yeah. I mean, I was just looking at that whilst you were talking. It's a really nice kind of wide photo of the whole thing. There's kind of joint courses running in practically every direction you can imagine. And yet it's also completely neatly put together. It really does look as if the stones have been somehow kind of melted and moulded to just fit the slot where they go. And, of course, the destruction of such a thing would take some doing, because we know that the whole reason they built this way was so that the whole mass of the structure bears down in such a way that kind of earthquakes ripple through them rather than knocking them over. Such that in Cusco, I know that there was an earthquake that destroyed a church on top of one of these ancient walls without actually disturbing the wall itself. So once again, we find this historical conundrum where it's pretty bloody amazing that somebody managed to build it. The idea that something came along and knocked it all down again is equally pretty wondrous and not something that people necessarily think about a lot. The next one, this lava extrusion slide, is really great. How many pairs of buttocks do you think that's seen over the years, mate?
Well, yeah, it's amazing. This thing's been here for a very long time. Goodness knows how long. Probably pre-Sacsayhuaman building time. And they've got a couple of car tyres down at the bottom to break people's fall. So I reckon that, you know, bums have been polishing this thing for like thousands of years, which is a great idea, isn't it?
Patrick's putting there, it's amazing what you can do with copper chisels and a stone, isn't it just, eh, Patrick? Isn't it just? And below, I only noticed it when we were talking about this, me and Synchro, earlier on. If you look below, you know, in the top right-hand corner of that shot, there's actually a whole shed load of other stuff there. You can see kind of, you can see structures and buildings and large, really quite large structures in there as well. And even beyond those ones, there's yet more. I mean, the place looks to be absolutely littered with really fascinating artifacts. I mean, once you got there, were you, how long did you spend there, and were you allowed to roam free?
Well, pretty much. I mean, there were people wandering around, checking the site, sometimes asking people for their tickets, because it wasn't a gated site. It's pretty much open countryside, but you are meant to pay something to go up there. So you could get in easily without a ticket, but you might be stopped and asked for your ticket. Mm-hmm. And they've got walkie-talkies. And if you go somewhere they really don't want you to go, they'll whistle at you and bring you back. But there are masses on that one mountain, which is the mountain between Cusco and Pisac, which is the nearest town on your way up the Sacred Valley or down the Sacred Valley. On that mountain, there are tens and tens of sites to visit. There's just too many, really. You can't.
And what's access like to them? Because I know that there's basically a thing with the sites, isn't there? You might as well explain broadly how the site visits are arranged for people, but it'd be interesting to know whether they were accessible to you, all of those.
Well, you had a ticket, you bought a ticket at the entrance to Sacsayhuaman, which would allow you to visit five other sites, which were the nearest, most important sites, if you like, or the most spectacular sites. So you could do that, but the ticket was only meant to last a day, which I thought was a bit of a shame, because you're paying like, I can't remember how much we paid now to go into Sacsayhuaman. I think it was... It wasn't the full tourist ticket thing, so it was limited to these sites and it was only for a day, so it was cheaper. It's probably about 10, 15 quid or something like that. Yeah. But honestly, once you've seen Sacsayhuaman and maybe wandered around quite a bit and sat around and enjoyed yourself, you could spend as much time there as you wanted to. I didn't really feel like going marching around another four sites that day, you know.
Well, it sounds to me, from what you're saying, that Sachsenhausen is therefore pretty unique because you weren't actually allowed to sit around in any of the other sites where you're pretty rapidly herded on.
Depending on the site, Machu Picchu, for example, a really famous example, people are only allowed in at a certain time and they have to leave by a certain time. Only so many people are allowed on the site at one time. So you are literally being shepherded through, and you wouldn't be allowed to just hang out there for the day and enjoy yourself, which you can do at Sachsenhausen.
Yeah, which is good. And once again, I mean, it just sounds like an entirely corporate exercise. These buses turn up, they spit you out, then a guy with a whistle comes along and puts you all on the bus and takes you somewhere else, and they keep doing that till you fall asleep, and they take you back to your hotel, sounds like to me. But I'm glad that Sachsenhausen, at least, you can go and, you know, hang around in the rocks, and it sounds like there's plenty to keep you amused there. So should they ever develop the teleport technology necessary to get the Doctor over there, that would be really great. After what happened to John Peel, though, I'm deeply suspicious of South American mountains. And the next shot is, I think, really brilliant. I love this one. This is a dreadlock llama, which Patrick, perhaps ungenerously, I don't know, and I don't know to whom, suggests might look like Dinny. Dinny must be a pretty styly-looking character, don't you think?
This was one of the greatest pics I had an opportunity to take of a brilliant dreadlocked llama. This was just above Sachsenhausen. And he was just tethered by the road to eat the grass there. And he was just looked like such a wonderful character. Doesn't he look like a great, great dude?
Tony's put it can't be, Dinny. It hasn't got a bottle in its mouth. Oh, yeah, this is one of my favourites, this shot. The next one, number 25, Coca Mama and Mama Coca. How did you come across this lady then?
Well, a lovely lady in this country who spends a lot of time in Peru, I know, called Steph. She told me which market to go to and where to find the lady with the best quality coca leaves in the whole of Peru. So I went to this market, which was great. We've got some photos actually down the line of the produce available in this market. It was out of this world. And I had enough Spanish to ask for where is the mama with the best coca. So they sent me all the way through the market to find Mama Coca. And she definitely had the best quality coca leaves I came across while I was over there. And she had them out the back. The bag out the front is not the best. She reaches out behind her, and I bought half a kilo from her. I didn't manage to actually get through the whole half kilo while I was out there.
And I can't tell you how angry she was when she found out that she couldn't just post it home, folks. She was not pleased.
I thought, well, it's just a leaf, you know. We should be able to just, like, you know, bring it home by the kilo. But it was wonderful to be able to. And, you know, all the hotels have coca tea available. They'll have a kettle there and mugs and coca leaves, and everybody's doing it. It's really very popular. And it's not just like the old geezers sitting around the square chewing the coca. Loads of people are at it. Yeah. It's great. There's a coca museum in Cusco where you can buy coca sweeties, coca toffees, coca liquor, coca honey, coca everything, you know.
I can give first-hand testimony that that is absolutely true, because we did have all of that stuff come home. And that's the funny thing, is you're not allowed to bring the leaves back, which is apparently as big an offence as bringing cocaine in, apparently. But once it's been corporatised, cellophane wrapped, taxed, transported around the place in a bit, yeah, fine, bring it home. And we loved a little bottle of liquor with the little Peruvian woolly hat on top of it.
The coca museum was amazing, full of information about the history of the coca, and some really ancient statues, clay models of geezers with these bulging cheeks, with their cheeks full of coca. And they've been doing it for millennia, you know, and it is a pretty harmless pastime.
Yeah, that's, of course, why they don't want us to do it, isn't it? Harmless. In fact, it's probably quite the opposite. Tony's quite correctly said, if you want to ship this stuff around the world, you need to call the CIA. That is absolutely right, apparently. Sadly, they are rumoured to be the people who are supplying most of the American youth and whatever it is with everything else. Now, this next shot is great. Slide 26. I've called it subsistence agriculture. clearly, quite clearly, with my tongue in my mouth. Will you look at that? Will you look at all that stuff? For people who can't see it, there's a really gloriously colourful photograph of a full market, and then there's a photo. The next one, top right, is all potatoes. Ha ha! Whoopee! Says the doctor. Total potatoes, loads of them. Then there's loads and loads of fruit, and then there's a whole stack of veg. Oh, that's brilliant. The food must have been really good there, wasn't it?
I mean, once you've discovered the markets in Peru, you can actually eat very, very cheaply and very healthily, just all the time. The top left photo there, for people who can see it, is Pisac Market, which is brilliant. But the other three photographs are from the Huanchac Market in Cusco, which is the same market that has the Mama Coca in it. And it was just the best market I have ever seen. The market in Urubamba was pretty good too, but this was amazing.
And do they do street food?
Yeah, loads of street food. Like I say, lots of meat, potatoes, fat, stodge. I mean, great.
Why can't we have street food here?
But, you know, you go into the markets and you can get, like, cheese and fried egg roll, if that's what you fancy, for pence, you know. It's really brilliant, really good value. Everybody's happy. And the juicing as well. I think we've got a photo, haven't we, of a juice stall in the markets. But, yeah. But, yeah, the food, once you've discovered the markets, you can live there very, very cheaply indeed and eat very well.
And these markets happen every week, do they? And this is a midwinter market.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, this one happens every day. The Huanchac Market in Cusco is there all the time. And whatever is seasonally available will be there. They have literally got, I think they've got hundreds of different varieties of potato, and quite a few of them are for sale in this market.
Wow, so do they have any supermarkets they can nip to if they can't find it at a market?
Well, I think there must be supermarkets somewhere, but I didn't see a single one.
Oh, maybe there aren't any. I mean,
I guess the cities must have them, but I didn't see them. I didn't see big supermarkets anywhere, which might be why the markets are doing so well. Yeah.
And the next shot are called social networking, and it's a load of people sitting around a tree using these kind of tree-mounted looms they've got, which I really like. The Maya use these as well, and one of the things that I always remember hearing about them is that they all break down into bits so that you can carry them around really easily, and the women have got different names for the parts than the men have, so they're using the same looms of the same parts, but the men's words for the bits are different from the women's words, which is the first time I've ever seen masculine and feminine in language make any sense to me. But I really like this shot again. You just have a quick look at the hats you can see from on top. Where'd you take that shot from? Is this some kind of it's a stitch and bitch, is it?
No, I was this was an exhibition that was on inside the grounds of a church in Cusco. So this was the gardens of the church, like a parterre design. And in each of the quadrants were a different tribe, group of people doing the weaving from their area. And all their produce was for sale there as well. And you knew that if you bought something there, that the money would go directly to the people who were making the goods. So it was an exhibition, and they were using the trees in the garden to hold their looms as they were weaving, and it was a brilliant event to attend, you know, because these people are all really happy, well-fed, successful people, and the weaving traditions have been resurrected, although they didn't entirely die. They could have done. They have been brought back to life, and now they're being sustained and perpetuated, and you know, it's good money for people.
And how many of us know how to make use of such a primary product as fibre, hey? How many of us know how to prepare that and use it? And these guys presumably do their own dyeing and stuff as well, do they?
Yeah, I mean, the traditional weavers are using, it's all natural dyes they use to make their fabrics. Wow. Totally.
Just look at the colours, man. Look at the colours. Wicked. Sod Benetton. I think these guys are doing a really great job. Next one is, in fact, called Local Colour by some strange coincidence. A bit of a close-up of some of the fabrics they wear. And you can see that although the... although some of the pictures, because they're at a distance, look like all they're doing is weaving things with stripes in them, actually what they're weaving is incredibly sophisticated. My guess is you must have seen some great fabrics on the way through.
Yeah, yeah. These people had just been doing a dance, and they were sitting down after the dance, so I just managed to catch... It's quite difficult to take photographs of people in traditional costume, because sometimes they're asking... Which is fair enough. Sometimes they're asking for money for photographs, but these people weren't. They were just sitting in the square, and I could take some photos.
The wacky hats again. I really, really like the hats.
I never saw such an amazing collection of hats, and the women seem to wear these. All the hats in Bolivia seem to be worn by the women.
Talking about that, except for in the next shot, maybe Copacabana Inca, it's called, with your travelling companion there standing between them. That's Lake Titicaca again, with a flotilla of very interesting looking boats on it. They do like the Inca, don't they?
Yeah, I think it's been kind of completely popularised, hasn't it? The Inca story, the Inca myth, yeah. And these are a couple of great big plastic Incas on the...
Of course. Actually have no idea who it was that built the stuff that's put down to the Inca, because they didn't do Sacsayhuaman, did they?
I think it's been kind of easy to pin it all on the Inca and make it popular, and that's what these guys are doing. I mean, it's pretty bizarre. You can see the size of my friend there. I mean, she's 5'5" or something like that, and look at the size of those guys. Yeah.
Right. And so what was Copacabana like? Sounds lovely.
It was just like I don't want to offend anybody here, really, but like, you know, the Blackpool of Bolivia and Peru combined, probably. It was.
Tell them about the pedalos.
Oh, yeah, all these pedalos, you know, pedalos, pedalling boats shaped like yellow ducks or yellow swans. I'm not quite sure whether they were ducks or swans, but there were hundreds of these things. And then at the weekend, they had... what do you call it, jet skis coming out from La Paz. People used to drive these really expensive jet skis out from La Paz to Lake Titicaca and charge a fortune for people to go whizzing round on them at the weekend.
And then the next shot, number 30, look what you have to go through if you want to take a bus trip to La Paz, guys. We did talk about this when we had a brief chat about this trip on when we were at the Conscious Tribal Gathering, and I described these kind of this sort of again a flotilla of boats. They've got quite a lot of these, and they put coaches on them. You can see the one on the left hand side is pretty much not quite a double decker, but it's a big coach, and they've got them on these really, and they take them, don't they, over the, this is over Lake Titicaca,
yeah, to get from Copacabana to La Paz on the bus. You've got to go over this narrow isthmus, if I can say it, in the lake. And apparently the government were threatening to build a bridge over this. But the boat guys locally said, because they've got a total monopoly on this crossing and they love it. And they said, no, they said, if you try to build a bridge, we'll kill the people who you send here to build it. So a bridge never got built and the guys have still got the monopoly on the boats.
Excellent. Bit of honesty there. That's really great, isn't it? Yeah, you try doing that, we're going to kill you. There you go. Governments all around the place. You could do with being that frank about what it is you're doing. That's all I can say. But they didn't let people travel on the buses, you'll be glad to hear. You had to actually travel separately. What were your, what were your travelling conditions like?
Well, they crammed as many people as possible into these people boats, which were incredibly bouncy. In fact, there were times when the crossings were delayed because the lake got so rough that the buses were in danger of being thrown off their barges, and a few buses have been thrown off their barges and landed in the bottom of the lake there, apparently.
Ripper, that sounds great, doesn't it? Some wrecks, but nobody drowned, hopefully. It did sound, from what Synchro was saying, that the passenger ferries, I'm not sure whether you wouldn't have felt safer going across in your bus, but there you go. Next shot is of Urubamba, which is one of the places that after you've done all your hard work and you're scrambling over the mountains and all your Sacsayhuamaning and stuff, you kind of went and hung out there, didn't you?
Yeah, it's a really lovely town, and I could recommend anybody who's going to Peru to take a few days out, basically, and go and visit Urubamba. I mean, it's down the Sacred Valley, as it's known, which has got Machu Picchu in it, amongst other things. And it's between Pisac and Ollantaytambo, which have been completely taken over by the tourist industry, which is fine if that's what you want. But Urubamba, this beautiful town, has just been completely left alone, and there aren't any tourists there, and they don't cater for tourists. So it's quite refreshing to take a bit of time out from all that chaos and come to a place which is simply functioning as a very, very successful, peaceful, abundant, harmonious community.
Because one of the things you said was that there's lots of small people moving around and not being oppressed by their elders, and you said even the dogs appeared to have a pretty independent society.
Well, that's true for all over Peru and Bolivia. The dogs seem to have their own world, their own thing going on. But here, this slide of the square in Urubamba, that's where it all happened, and everybody gathered there every night. Families would come out, the kids would be out playing together. There were popcorn makers with their trolleys and ice cream sellers, and the whole place was just vibrant with life.
I remember that being, it's kind of similar in some places in Spain, isn't it? Everybody sort of comes out and hangs around and has coffee or pizza or whatever. I remember that from those little white villages.
Yeah, and that does happen in Spain still, and I think maybe there's so many connections between South America and Spain for one reason or another, that, you know, they've culturally there's a lot of similarities. Yeah.
And next slide along, number 32, is Salt Springs from the Mountain. This is something that Jess got quite a lot of photos of this, and these are just two of the best ones. I was personally very, very surprised to find that there's salt springs coming from mountains sort of 13,000 feet above the sea, even though the whole lot was lifted up during a cataclysm some while ago, and Lake Titicaca is nominally a saltwater lake. It's not nothing like so salty as it was. So I'm completely amazed to see this. There's salt water running out, and they've got terraces where they collect it all and shunt it out and sell it. And doesn't it look beautiful? Look at that top left, the shot on the left there. On the right hand side of it, there's this really amazing corrugated iron. The colours in that are completely stunning because of the salt in the air and the rust. But what was that? It's got to be one of the most amazing shots of your walk, isn't it?
Yeah, it was great because we didn't visit this as official visitors. There's a town called Maras, which is above the salt terraces, and people usually come here in busloads, and hundreds, many, many hundreds of busloads of people come here every day, like it's on the tour. You will go to visit the salt terraces. But you can walk from Maras, the town, down this beautiful track, past the salt terraces, and right down to the main road at the bottom, cross the Urubamba River. You don't have to pay a cent. You can even partake of their stalls and shops and stuff on your way through, and nobody wants a dime off you, which actually gave us quite a kick because of all the charging and everything. So I had a total eyeful of these wonderful salt terraces, and I didn't have to pay a penny.
And that, folks, is raw money just sitting on the hillside. It's been money for as long as people can remember, salt. And there it is, pouring out of a mountainside. Anybody in the chat box heard of that happening before? Because I'm just wondering how that's occurring, you know. And
they're thousands of years old, these salt terraces. Yeah. Thousands of years old. We don't know how old.
Yeah. There you go. Cash just pouring out of a mountainside, eh? That's the way it actually works, you know. That's the way it works. And now we get to Ollantaytambo, always one of my favourite photographic subjects. And one of the real problems with Urubamba was that they did crap coffee there, but you found a solution to that, didn't you?
Yeah, because people in Peru and you know, native people, they don't do coffee and they don't do tea either, actually. They do coca tea and herb tea and stuff. But you can't get a decent cup of coffee before 11:30, 12:00 in the morning, if you're lucky. And that's a bit late for me on a holiday day. So you can get a bus, you can get a minibus, colectivo, from Urubamba up to Ollantaytambo. And because it's totally geared up for tourists, you can get a decent cup of coffee of organic, you know, Peruvian home roasted beans at 7:30 in the morning. Totally cool.
Excellent. Let's just get up in the morning and take a bus to Ollantaytambo for some freshly roasted coffee, shall we? And look at the state of this place, guys. That first shot, the one on the left. I mean, I know the terraces can some, because there's terraces on the left there underneath all of these superstructures, and I know that they can be a lot wider than they look. But these steps look really big. I mean, what's going on there?
No, they are terraces, and some of them did, I suppose they had to accommodate the steepness of the hill. And some of them are very small, but they're not so small when you actually...
see, there's people on here.
Yeah, yeah, there's people on there.
But those steps, there's people on those steps there, and to the left of the steps as well, and they're bloody tiny.
Mm. Well, they used to terrace everything, because the hills are so steep. The terraces are going to be quite steep and small in some places.
Okay, they look barely wide enough to stand on.
I think that's a bit of a perspective thing going on. They were wider than that, depending on where you were looking at them from.
Fabulous mountain range in the background, again, echoing the actual built structure in front of it. I mean, couldn't we start doing a bit of that kind of stuff, you know? Mm. It's so attractive.
Yeah, I did all this with my zoom lens, yeah, because I wasn't actually... willing to join in.
I'm going to pay the money. And the lady there that's on the right hand picture, you can, if you look closely, you can see how detailed some of this weaving actually is that they're doing. They're amazing, complex pictures and shapes utilizing loads of different colors, which I think is just an astonishing thing to be able to do.
Yeah, there's loads of people still do the weaving. And, of course, it's quite profitable for quite a lot of people now to do the weaving and keep those traditions going. So that's good. A lot of people around Urubamba, Ollantaytambo, wear traditional costumes as a daily thing. There's some wonderful orange woven patterned ponchos around Urubamba that the men wear, which look fantastic, you know. They just look absolutely amazing.
Next shot is of Ollantaytambo streets, and here you go, here you got people actually living in ancient structures, really, because there's big stones used here that are probably well pre-Inca. Nobody knows who put them there, but one of the things about these ancient peoples is that they were extremely good at moving water about the place and storing it and keeping it clean and things like that. And I noticed there's a gutter running down here. Do you see a lot of that in Ollantaytambo?
Loads of that. There was water running everywhere, and it looked pretty clean to me too, which was nice, because it was going down to flow into the Urubamba River, which was not, sadly, it was not clean at all. It's a seriously polluted river running down what is, you know, like I say, known as the Sacred Valley.
What is it? Only 1%, or is it 2% at the most, of the water on the planet is clean to drink. And we're pouring shit into it everywhere. And yet these guys, whoever it was who put this place together, and several of the Maya sites and several of the Olmec sites, were absolutely brilliant at moving water about and preserving it for their use. It's shocking, absolutely shocking, that we should even begin to claim to be civilized when we're building things that look so shite and don't work properly, and we can't even look after our own water. I was going to try not to have a bit of a rant. I love looking at these old places and just seeing what our ancestors have been capable of and looking at what we're doing. I mean, look at this next one, this Inca storehouse. This genuinely is an Inca product, isn't it? But again, what a totally amazingly wacky thing.
Yeah, again, I took this with my zoom lens, which thankfully was working pretty well. But I have seen, you can see this stuff on YouTube and that. You can go looking for these and get a walk about with somebody taken a closer look. But even from a distance, you know, these places look amazing, beautifully built. And they had storehouses to store up food so that when there was a time of famine and drought and stuff, that people would have plenty of the food. And that was one of the reasons why the Inca were so successful, I think, was that everybody had had food most of the time.
Yeah. Well, they are, I think that one of the aims of these big storehouses was that the they had a kind of monarchy, didn't they? They had a sort of royalty that moved around the place, and they needed to make sure, the idea was that places would make sure that they always had enough stuff in to feed the monarchy when they turned up. And when they turned up, I've no doubt they probably ate them out of house and home. But, of course, they couldn't go everywhere at once, and it did mean that they had stuff stored up. They were really brilliant at it as well. They even built a kind of experimental contoured thing in the ground, didn't they? Do you remember seeing pictures of that?
I've seen pictures of it, and we very nearly went to visit it. We got quite close to it, in fact, to the gate where they wanted £35 of us to go in there. Oh. So we decided to leave it to the documentaries for our view of Morai, as it's known, which always sounds quite Midlands accent to me, but yeah, we didn't go in there.
That's a shame, because it's basically what it is it's a hole in, if you imagine a load of concentric circles drawn on the ground, quite big ones, and then you imagine each one is cut into a terrace that kind of goes down and down and down until you end up with a circle at the bottom of the hole. And if you go down and stand on that circle, you're effectively surrounded by 360-degree terraces that reach 8 or 10 levels above your head. So it's completely perfect climate experiment for seeing what will grow where. Utterly, utterly stunning thing to have done.
Yeah, they call it the Inca Laboratory because they reckon that they were experimenting with these different microclimates that were created by these layers down in the thing. You can see it on YouTube.
Next shot's really cracker as well, 36, number 36, which is called New Bricks from Old. These guys are taking down an adobe brick wall. Again, just catch that fabulous background. They're taking down an adobe brick wall, and they're busy carting the adobe bricks away to use them somewhere else, which they can easily do because
there's one size fits all. They use this adobe technology all over Peru and Bolivia, and there is only one size of brick. Isn't that brilliant? There's one mold, one size of brick, so they can be reused, used to patch up old buildings or whatever, because they're all the same.
Totally great. Not the way we tend to do things over here, is it, where absolutely every single bloody bulb is completely different from the bulb you want to put into the socket and all that kind of stuff. And these guys taking this wall down, carrying all the bricks away. You know, what happens here nowadays is they knock down the building, they send in a big machine which chews it all up, spits it out, and they just build the new building on top of that. That's basically mound building. So we haven't just got Mesopotamian agriculture and bloody religion. We've got Mesopotamian building techniques, whereas these guys take it all away and use it again. Which one of these two methods do we think is more to our advantage, eh? And the next one, slide 37, is new bricks from mud and grass. Love these pictures, these guys.
Yeah, well, I was taking these a friend in mind, because she's interested in starting to make adobe bricks in this country. So I was taking these photographs for her, really, but it is pretty interesting. I mean, they just use mud and grass, a very fine grass. There's the mould in the left-hand photo there, which is the universal mould for Peru and Bolivia and probably other South American countries as well, all one size, and there they are all laid out. And this was quite a village-scale production, but they do a much larger-scale production in some places, but they're still using exactly the same techniques.
Brilliant. Bricks from mud and grass. That's actually how it works, folks. It's brilliant, isn't it, these people? I really enjoyed looking at these slides, because you can see it honestly wasn't too far different from that here not too long ago. And I just think it's incredible to see these people still doing this. They say that you couldn't actually use adobe bricks. I hear this argument quite a lot because it's too wet in Wales. I can kind of understand that, although obviously you could work your way around that. But I am told that there's adobe buildings in Berlin that were put up before the Second World War, I think, that are still there. So you can mud, it's really great, and it's totally free. But it's really, really difficult to get it past building regs because the building regs are stupid. Kipu, keeping an account, the next one. We're getting very nearly to the end now. Thanks very much for your time, Synchro. So, well, aren't these are pretty, aren't they? Do we know what they are?
Well, if you've not heard of Kipu, then you can go and find out about them, I'm sure. But basically, we don't know very much about them. We don't understand them at all. Some people probably still do. But they are a form of keeping records. And some people believe that they actually tell the story of a history in the knots that are tied in the various threads and the intervals between the knots. And some people think that they can also be used for accounting and keeping quite close records in that kind of way. So we really don't know. Again, research is being done. Some people probably know and maybe they're not telling, I don't know. But it's something we have not yet deciphered and maybe we never will.
No, quite so. I think it's very difficult, isn't it? You always need a Rosetta Stone. I mean, with Egyptian, there was the Rosetta Stone. With the Sumerian script, there was the Cyrus the Great triple carving in three languages, 500 foot up a cliff in the middle of a desert. With the Maya, the Rosetta Stone turned out to be the language being spoken by the modern Maya, which I think is really brilliant. But there is no Rosetta Stone for the Kipu. Patrick's saying, is it like a tally stick? I think it certainly is like a tally stick, but I think that's looking to be perhaps its most primitive use, if you like, because it's starting to... We've known for a long time that these peoples are weaving their stories into the fabric, that the patterns in the fabrics are stories kind of made manifest, if you like. But I think it's beginning to be suspected that these are actually quite complex means of keeping records that might even be a form of written language, isn't that?
Well, I mean, like I say, I mean, I just think they're really beautiful, intriguing objects. And there's about 600 of them known around the world, apparently, and everybody's intrigued by them, as am I, and I have no clear idea. I think they used to keep records, apparently, of when a new bridge was built, and all the communities used to bring rope to the making of the bridge. They used to keep that kind of tally, the records, on a kipu.
They'd make the... on a family level, they'd make the string, or individual level, they'd make the string, and then a family together would come to make a fibre, which then a whole group of people would come together to make a rope, and then the whole bundle of people who'd made all the ropes would come together and build a bridge. How much fun must that have been?
And they kept that kind of record on the kipu, so we know that that happened, and they were quite detailed, but we still have no idea how to read them.
And then these last two shots are, well, we're coming up to the end now. There's one called Ancient Weaving, Ancient Tale, and that's an example of an old piece of cloth that you saw in a museum and weren't supposed to be photographing, isn't it, Synchro? But fabulous.
I couldn't resist taking the photographs, and I was in a bit of a hurry because there was a camera in there, and I thought, well, I better just click photographs as quick as I can and then get out of here. And this was in the basement of that Scotia Bank, where they had that wonderful Martin Chambi exhibition. And if you haven't seen the photographs taken by Martin Chambi in Peru, I suggest you have a look on YouTube, or just Chambi is Chambi, and well worth a look. There were three enormous rooms of this guy's photographs in this bank, this Scotia Bank in Cusco. It wasn't...
Don't ask us what on earth this was doing in the Scotia Bank, and you had to actually walk through the offices to get to it, didn't you? Yeah,
this place was not well advertised. He is such a brilliant photographer, and you had to walk through the offices of the bank to actually get to these to these rooms of photographs.
Yeah, did they have anything else interesting in the bank synchro?
Well, these downstairs, they had these things. We also passed a room and the door was open and it was full of human skulls. And there were people in there with masks on their mouths and head gear on and white coats and stuff, brushing these masks with fine brushes. And I asked them if I could take a photograph, and somebody nearly said yes, and then the kind of woman said no, I couldn't take a photograph. I was well pissed off. That would have made a wonderful shot.
So which town was this in?
This is all in Cusco. Okay,
so in Cusco we have a Scotiabank, which has got the basically the pinnacle of their photographic exhibitions somewhere on the other side of its offices. It's got a load of these really beautiful ancient fabrics in it, and it's got a room full of skulls.
Yeah.
Why can't we have banks like that over here? I might consider having a bloody bank account if they were going to do that sort of stuff. But I do find myself wondering what all of that is doing in a bank. They're not supposed to have anything valuable left, are they? Or perhaps that's just me. Anyway, this piece of fabric here, which is entitled "Ancient Weaving Ancient Tale," take a look at the symbol. Most of them are quite comprehensible symbols on that. You see, no, it's okay. You can see there's animals, there's a skunk, there's a sheep, you can see a llama. There's all sorts of things that are beautifully characterised on it. But if you look at the right-hand column, three up from the bottom, A, look at the detail in it, and B, what do you suppose it is? Talking of which, the next slide is called Detail of a Detail, and it's another piece of cloth that was held in the Scotiabank. We've got a few photos of those. And if you look in the centre column of that and down the bottom, I actually zoomed in on that whilst we were producing the slide, and what the hell do you suppose that is? Fantastic piece of weaving, though. What do you think it is, Synchro?
Well, I have no idea. I hadn't noticed it until you picked it out today. I mean, it looks like some kind of craft, doesn't it?
It does. Apparently Jason said it's the Death Star.
Well, yeah, it may be, but it looks like there's a baby alpaca or baby llama in the top right window.
Yeah, but there's something with bloody tentacles under in the cellar, look. And there's a kind of tree in there as well. I think it's the moon, that's what I think it is, but I'm known to be slightly obsessed on that subject.
Who knows, but yeah. These were some of the most beautiful weavings I saw the whole time. They're quite old, and they used to put, the people used to put so much value on these weavings. They were the most valuable thing they had, and they couldn't really understand the Spanish obsession with gold and silver, because weaving and fabric were their greatest wealth.
Yeah, things created by human hands and human ingenuity, and really I think that's a brilliant place to more or less finish the slideshow, because, I mean, just look at that. Look at the amazing detail and the colour, and it's awesome, you know. And we've seen in these photographs the technologies that those people are using to make this sort of thing, and the creatures from which they get the prime fibre to do it, and they're dyeing it all with natural colours and all that kind of stuff. It's just brilliant, just amazing, and I'm really, thanks very much for bringing your photos along and showing them to us.
Oh, I've really enjoyed it. Cheers. I hope it's not been too boring for the non-travelling, non-walking people amongst us.
Nick Nomick said, can we read that much into the designs when folks who weave them can score a huge bag of coca and more? That's great. And the final shot before we say goodbye to Synchro is Synchro walking off into the distance. There she is, Synchro in a pretty rugged landscape, walking towards a hill that looks remarkably like a wizard's hat. And who knows what the view is over that horizon, Synchro?
Well, that was another pass we were heading to the top of there. I think we did about four of those on the walk, and it was a fantastic achievement, you know. And I know now I've done one that's classed as advanced, so I might do another one of those at some point, hey?
Brilliant. Perhaps if you make it away again, perhaps I really will make it down to Brighton this time. I really, really enjoyed that.
Cheers, everyone. one.
It looks like they've really enjoyed it in the chat box as well. Jess thought we should really hammer through those and get it over in an hour because she didn't want to bore you folks. But in the end, I just couldn't really rush it because thanks very, very much for all of your appreciation. The picks are great, aren't they? They're just taken on a little Lumix portable thing, which has got a dirty sensor, apparently. There you go. So it goes. So thank you very much, Synchro. I'm sure you'll join us again one day, won't you?
Brilliant. Thanks. I really enjoyed it. And really enjoyed keeping an eye on the chat box as well when it's going on.
Excellent stuff. Well, we're all just done. We'll just click over to the broadcasting unit and we'll have a couple of tunes whilst we get our act together. Cheap sunglasses. You'd need at least a pair of those, wouldn't you, if you were going right over there?